Welcome to Missing Maura Murray. Tonight we have a special episode. We talk to podcast host and journalist Scott Reeder about his new podcast, Suspect Convictions.
Yeah, it was fascinating talking to him. You'll see right when we start that we spend about 10 minutes on Maura, and he starts talking about his story, and it's his discovery of this murder victim. Not to do a crazy disclaimer, but the subject matter is dark. The murder itself is very gruesome, but he just gets into it. He sits back, closes his eyes, and he just goes with it. And it's a very fascinating experience for him, and it's an experience for the listener, too, to put yourself there.
Yes, he was there the night of the murder, and so a lot of the podcast is sort of based on his experience investigating and reporting this murder, but also being there that night.
And those details are they're embedded in his head, and he relives it, the smell, the sounds, the people who were next to him, what he did, what he was told. Super, super interesting.
And we do spend about 10 minutes, as you said, on Maura. He started the conversation talking about James Renner's book, and we just kind of said, let's just start rolling.
Right, because there was no stopping the Scott Reeder train.
And there was no formal beginning.
Right.
So we just kind of started going once we realized we were in the conversation. So if it seems like you're entering in the middle of a conversation, that's why. So check out Suspect Convictions. We think you'll like it. And also, check out us at CrimeCon in June. June 9th through 11th in Indianapolis, we are speaking with James Renner at a conference called CrimeCon, Crime Convention.
Did you say it's in Indianapolis, Indiana?
Yeah.
In June?
In June.
Where else do you want to be?
We're talking on June 11th, which is a Sunday, and they now have available day passes. So use code MMPOD20 and get 20% off for your pass, day pass, or VIP pass, wherever you want to go with it. We're going to be there the whole weekend. So
is that a real code?
Yeah, MMPOD20. Yeah, and come talk to us. We want to meet you.
I wish we had known about the promo code before we booked.
I know, we paid full price.
We paid full price. So take advantage of our mistake. Do what we didn't do.
Use it. Code MMPOD20 for 20% off, and come see us at CrimeCon. You're going to have a lot of fun.
She's a college kid in Massachusetts. She has connections into the domestic battery shelter underground network that's supposedly out there. I just don't buy it. And the other thing is, her Google searches and stuff didn't reflect somebody looking to disappear. I mean, I just don't buy into that. Now, you know, whether she was pregnant or not, I don't know. I thought the evidence of it was fairly lame, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a nursing student and she runs through a couple of Google searches about, you know, pregnancy and stuff. It could be her, but it also could be, you know, she just wants to know she's working on the hospital floors and wants to have some information. Maybe she's doing it for class. I don't know. I think of some of the crazy things I Google just because I'm curious about them. We have three daughters, and I remember how my wife is. You know, she's a veterinarian, a medical professional. I mean, she was like, the day we found out we were expecting, each time, she quit consuming anything that could be, you know, she wouldn't even take Tylenol. She wouldn't take, drink a soda. I mean, we don't drink, but I mean, it was like, okay, I find it really hard to believe that this nursing student who is supposedly so concerned about the baby that she's going to flee the nation and hide for the rest of her life is going to load up with a bunch of booze in a car and drive off and consume while she's driving. That just doesn't make any sense to me. It just doesn't add up. I mean, I just think that Renner's conclusion there is just absolutely nuts.
You mentioned the simplest conclusion is usually the one. What do you think is the simplest conclusion in the Moriarty case?
To be honest with you, I think the simplest conclusion is the most tragic conclusion. I think that she encountered somebody after that crash that did her harm. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not that uncommon. I mean, I shouldn't say it's that uncommon, but I mean, I've covered a lot of missing person cases over the last 30 years, and there are a lot of people that just disappear. I mean, I remember when I was a reporter in Galveston, Texas, 30 years ago, there was a really notorious missing persons case, a girl about the same age as Maura, that was just working at a condominium complex and just vanished. I mean, they found one shoe of hers, and her name was Renee Richardson, and they have no idea to this day what happened to her. I mean, the parents have said, I think I've read online, that they believe that she's dead and so she was kidnapped. But we don't really know. I mean, I think about when I was in college, there was a girl named Tammy Zawicki, who was traveling from Evanston, Illinois to Grinnell, Iowa. And she just vanished somewhere along the interstate. And her body was found a long time later somewhere in Missouri. You know, I mean, it's tragic and it's horrible to think that way. But to me, that seems like the most obvious answer here. I mean, what other answers do you have? I mean, I can't believe that she could successfully hide for 13 years, considering the number of people actively looking for her. That's just my take on it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Totally agree with you on the not being able to hide, especially hiding in this country, the country that you were born in and you have citizenship in, is one thing, but hiding in a country, even if it is Canada, hiding in a country that you need to get insurance, and if you are pregnant, you have to go to have that child somewhere, and you're just walking into a hospital and sneaking out with your baby after in Canada, you have to get some sort of identification card. You have to get a job. That child is now going to school. Like, how is it possible that she is manipulated to this point and still not gotten caught with a child?
It sounded to me like, you know, she's a West Pointer for a stretch, incredibly hard institution to get into. She seemed to be very book smart. But forgive me, but she seemed to be the type of person that did profoundly stupid things. I mean, we all know folks like that who have a high level of intelligence, but not any common sense to at all. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It just doesn't compute with me that she could have figured out this way of avoiding the police, avoiding public scrutiny, secretly giving birth to a child, raising the child, and avoiding detection for 13 years. I just doesn't make sense to me at all.
Yeah, no, and really no traces of her, like no proof of her attempting an escape like that was ever found either.
I guess you could go to a public library and do those Google searches or something, but even that, I just don't buy it. You know, I've been wrong before. Let me tell you this story. I remember 30 years ago or 29 years ago, I was working on a Saturday in the newsroom at the Galveston Daily News, and this woman calls me and she says she's really worried about her son, Mark, and he is a college student at the University of Texas, and he just disappeared went to spring break, and he was supposed to come home the day before from spring break, and he didn't come home. And I said, well, where's he at? And he said, South Padre. And I'm thinking, okay, he's 5 hours away from Galveston. You know, I mean, you know, I've been down to South Padre for spring break when I was in college, and it's like, I can just imagine, like, hey guys, let's hang out here for another day. We're having a good time, and you know, we'll come home. And I said, you know, ma'am, he's only been got out for a day. I really wouldn't worry about him. You know, I'm sure he's fine. He's just probably having a really good time down there with his friends, and you know, he just, you know, he'll be fine. Don't worry about it, is basically what I told her. Well, he turns out he ended up being kidnapped by a gang of cannibalist drug smugglers who hacked him up into pieces, and there was a cult down there that was, they were eating their people. And this is like the most bizarre thing in the world. So I gave the simplest, most sincere solution I could to this mother when she called me. And we find out like a week later, no, he was kidnapped by cannibals in Mexico and devoured. I mean, so I say, I only share that story with you to say sometimes I'm really, really wrong.
So with the rare exception of he just didn't want to spend an extra day. No, it wasn't just kidnapped by drug dealers. It wasn't just kidnapped by a gang. It was a cannibal gang.
A cannibal gang. If you ever curious about the case, Google Mark Kilroy. That was the case. So I felt really stupid after that, I might add. But I was 23, 24 years old at the time, and that seemed like the most simple solution I could come up with. Wow. So yeah,
I wouldn't beat yourself up too much over feeling stupid over that. I don't know if you could have figured that one out just with the given information.
Who could have predicted that?
Yeah, I mean, no, exactly. So I usually go with the simplest solution, but you know, there's a number of cases I've covered over the last 30 years where we never have found out the answer when somebody disappears. And you know, you're left really wondering. It's particularly hard when, you know, like I remember a case I covered, Jerry Walking was the guy's name, I believe. It's been more than 20 years. He was this very ordinary guy, father, adult children. He went to John Deere factory every day and worked, and he never missed a day of work his entire career. I mean, he was just as punctual as can be. One day he doesn't show up for work. Police find his car at the airport in Moline, Illinois. There's a little bit of blood, if I remember right, near the car. To this day, nobody knows what happened to him. I mean, it's been decades. So, you know, we're as our human nature is just a thirst for answers. That's why we listen to podcasts like this. That's why you and I produce podcasts like this, because we really want to know answers. Sometimes answers just remain elusive forever.
This is a good moment to formally and properly introduce yourself. You've brought up a couple of cases. You've mentioned that you're an investigator. Can you introduce yourself, your title, a little bit of your background, and then the reason why we're talking to you about your podcast?
Okay, sure. My name's Scott Reeder. I'm a journalist. I've been doing this for 30 years, which is hard to believe. Early on in my career, I covered courts and crime in a variety of cities. And then for the last 18 years, I've been covering state legislatures, and that's why I'm based out of Springfield, Illinois right now, is I've done that. I ran a national news service for a stretch for about 3 years, and I ran a statewide news service for about 4 years. And you know, I've done a variety of things over the years, and as I was telling you folks before we started recording, about a year ago, I decided to make a career change. I wanted to do something I was really passionate about and my wife says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I really want to write a book about this murder case I covered as a very young reporter. And it's always fascinated me. And she said, well, do it. So started writing the book, doing the research for the book. Then I, as I was saying, I was listening to the podcast Serial with my wife as we're driving down the road. And I said, this is really fascinating. But, you know, the murder case I'm writing about is so much more interesting. And so the next day I called up a friend with an NPR affiliate in Rock Island, Illinois, at WVIK. And I made the pitch, and make a long story short, within 3 days, we ended up in a partnership with the radio station producing a podcast called Suspect Convictions. And it just took off. It shot up to number 2 on iTunes very rapidly. It still remains extremely popular. I would really recommend, it's a fascinating case, and I'd recommend to your listeners not just to listen to it, but to subscribe to it, because as we're nearing the end of the first season, but we got some really exciting stuff coming up over the summer and over in the fall. And if you don't subscribe, you're going to miss that. But we're going to look at some other interesting cases involved. But this case is really something that hit me right between the eyes. I was 24 years old. I was a night police reporter in Davenport, Iowa, and I got dispatched to a small fire at a school playground. And this is the kind of assignment when an editor gives it to you, you're going, this is just stupid. Why am I getting sent to cover a garbage fire? I mean, it seemed really dumb. And I drove up there. I got there at the same time as the first police officer. We could see the smoke rising from some tall weeds on the edge of the playground. And the two of us walked over to the fire. I got about 2 feet away from the flames and looked down. Instead of being a trash fire, it was a 9-year-old girl that had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. It was the most horrific thing I've ever seen in my life. And I hope that I ever do see. And I just was like, you know, I radioed back, you know, there was a body at the scene, and the detectives got there and the firefighters got there. And it was just a really horrible thing. They identified this young girl. Her name was Jennifer Lewis. She'd grown up in extremely tragic circumstances. Her mother had moved from one relationship to another, and all these guys seemed to have problems with the law. According to courtroom testimony, Jennifer's parents were engaged in the drug trade, and the police immediately brought both of them in, a stepfather and the mother, and put them through polygraph tests, and they both passed it. So then they started looking about who around these folks should they look at. And there was a guy by the name of Stanley Liggins who was, according to testimony in court, was supplying cocaine to the parents to sell in the west end of Rock Island, which is a very rough area. And the police didn't have much evidence against him, but they started to look at him real hard. And they brought him in for a polygraph exam, and he failed it. Now, that sounds very damning, but the reality is polygraphs are just a tool in the mix. They're only as good as the examiner using them. The examiner was pretty new at this time. He'd been doing polygraph exams for less than a year. The police, when they started investigating, they found that, you know, he had proximity to the family. He had been over at their house that day. He'd given $1 supposedly to Jennifer to go to a nearby liquor store and buy him a pack of gum. And she went to the liquor store, she bought the gum, and left, and that was the last time anybody knows where she was, other than the killer, as far as we know. So police continue to look at this guy, and some folks have seen him near the little girl the day before, just chatting with her on the street, which would seem normal because she came and went from their house all the time. And he had been arrested on a fairly minor offense involving a child the month before, when he was out on bond. So there was a lot of things that, I shouldn't say minor, I should say, compared to what Jennifer experienced, it was minor. Obviously, in the eyes of the victim and what she's experienced in life, it was very major. I mean, I don't want to belittle anybody who's gone through that experience, but so you have this guy they're looking at, and the community is just an absolute terror. It's a metropolitan area of about 250,000, half in Iowa, half in Illinois, straddles the Mississippi River, obviously. And I've never been any place where there was that kind of palatable fear. Parents weren't letting their kids out of their sight. They were just terrified. And they were prosecutor in the case, very able courtroom lawyer, went to his office, talked to all the attorneys that worked for him and said, who here thinks we have enough evidence to arrest Stanley Liggins and charge him with Jennifer's murder? He said, not one person in that office said, there's enough evidence here to charge him. And he said, but you know what? I don't answer to the lawyers in my office. I answer to the voters of Scott County, Iowa. And he charged him. So, very little of evidence on that. They searched the hotel room where he is living. Didn't find any evidence of Jennifer having been there. Her birthday, her 10th birthday was 3 days later. They did find some birthday presents and some other evidence, but the girlfriend, his girlfriend was child was having a birthday coming up too, same time. So that in itself wasn't particularly surprising. They found a stun gun, but the guy was a drug dealer. So that in itself wasn't particularly surprising that he owned a stun gun. So they searched the house. They searched his hotel room, really a dirtbag hotel room, and don't find anything. They find absolutely no evidence at the scene of the fire of him being there. When they did the autopsy on Jennifer, they found that she had been sexually violated. They couldn't tell if it was anally or vaginally because the tissue between the rectum and the vagina had been so badly traumatized it was impossible to tell in what way she'd been violated.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. No, it was a 9-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And they didn't find any semen, but she had been doused with gasoline, obviously, and set on fire. The hyoid bone in her neck was intact, but they found that she'd been manually strangled. You know, it was just, there was a lot of things there, but they couldn't find any evidence on the body of Stanley Liggins, any hair or body fluids or DNA under the fingernails or anything else. And then they, he had a car he drove around, and they searched and scoured the car for any evidence, because supposedly he would have had to have transported the body to the fire scene in this car. They found not even a trace evidence of Jennifer ever having been in that car. And it's like, okay, how can this be? I mean, it just, transporting a body, from what I've read, is not the easiest thing in the world because, you know, all the sphincters open up and, you know, there's bodily fluids that are leaking and, you know, it's not an easy thing. So
could it be possible that she was killed at the scene where she was found and not dead before she was transported?
It's possible, but it would seem like a very odd place for that to have happened because it was behind an elementary school, right? And, you know, in a neighborhood, and you know, anything's possible.
Would it be possible to, there was some talk on the on one of the episodes about the trash bags that were used, that they were industrial trash bags that were provided by the motel, correct? That that was something that was exclusive to that type of facility. And if, is that part of the thinking? If she was killed, she could have been put in that trash bag and then put into the trunk and thereby no bodily fluids.
Exactly. That is the thing. She was wrapped. We do know that she was wrapped in trash bags because when I got to the fire scene, I couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl that I was looking at because the body had been so badly consumed, but also the trash bags she had been wrapped in had melted around her. And it was, you could tell it was a child, but that's about all I could tell at the time. So we know that. In fact, it's interesting she brought up the trash bags because you cited the entire extent of the forensic evidence in this case. There's been more than 10,000 samples taken for the fire scene, the car, and the hotel room. Nothing definitively linking the victim and the accused. The trash bags were the type brand of trash bags that was used at the hotel were the same as what was found on Jennifer's body. But it was not a... It was a hefty brand used for industry, like in hotels and things like that, not like at the grocery store. But it wasn't an extraordinarily uncommon brand either. I mean, it was a hefty. I mean, there's some questions there. I think that is the closest that we have as far as forensic evidence linking the two, but it's still very tenuous. Mm-hmm. So about a week after Stanley was arrested, this woman came forward about a week after the Stanley was arrested. She said she was looking out her window that night and saw the fire in the school playground, and she saw taillights near it. The police took her into the police station, to the garage, and showed her the car that Stanley was driving. And she said, yeah, those are the taillights I saw. Well, that's curious. I mean, the car was a little bit unusual. It was Peugeot. And, of course, in 1990 in Iowa, that was a pretty uncommon vehicle. So it's a little bit unusual. But here's what never came out for 20 years. The witness that was who identified this woman became the star witness in the case. When the case went to trial, they literally rolled into the courtroom the back half of this Peugeot, and they had it underneath a shroud, you know, like they're unveiling a statue. And when this woman took the stand, they turned off. They unveiled the car, and the jurors just gasped. And then they turned off the lights in the courtroom, and they used a little motorcycle battery to turn on the taillights. And the woman sitting there on the witness stand said, I'd recognize those taillights anywhere. Those are the taillights I saw. That has to be the car. And they were, they did have a bit of a distinctive pattern. But we find out 20 years later, this woman was a paid police informant. And then 87 other cases, other than the Jennifer Lewis case. And you stop and think about that. Well, and that was never disclosed to the defense or to anyone else that she had been a paid police informant. And it's like, what are the odds that, you know, this woman also happens to be a police informant? Now, the testimony, the cases that she'd worked on were all, for the most part, before she testified. But after Jennifer she had worked in the Jennifer case, and you kind of wonder what the defense is trying to say is, well, was she promised something in exchange for this testimony? Was she hey, we'll take care of you. We'll get you money coming in. This is somebody who was living very much in a subsistence lifestyle at the time. We don't know. I mean, we don't know what's saying. I mean, we have one lawyer who took the stand and a couple weeks in February and said he thinks that she was outright paid by the police. Now, to give this testimony, that was what his testimony was. We really don't know, but it's very concerning to me that her identity as a police informant was never revealed to the defense or to anyone else and for decades. So that's part of it. The other key witness in this case was Stanley Liggins' cellmate. He was held in the county jail, and he shared the cell with this career criminal, rough guy named Frank Rising. He's in his early 50s right now, and he served over 25 years of his adult life in prison. So, fair amount of time. And he came in and he testified that Stanley Liggins had admitted to him that he killed Jennifer Lewis. So these became the two critical witnesses in the case. And people, you know, the jurors, based primarily on these two people, voted for convictions. And the identity of the jurors was interesting to me because I hunted them down, you know, 27 years later, and I interviewed them, and the people they had on the jury were very good, and some of them, like, how on earth are they allowed on the jury? One of these guys was a white South African who had come to the United States right after Nelson Mandela came to power in South Africa. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, Stanley Liggins is black, Jennifer Lewis is white. I don't claim to be the most knowledgeable person when it comes to criminal defense, but I think getting a white South African who had just left right after Nelson Mandela came to power to move to Iowa might raise a red flag for me. I mean, like, wait a minute, I don't want this guy on the jury. But, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. Not every white South African had racist beliefs. Some did, some didn't. So I called him up, and I said, you know, I'm talking to him, and I said to him, well, tell me something. I got to ask, because you're from South Africa, do you consider yourself racist? And he goes, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'm thinking, thank goodness. And he goes, I think black people as a whole in the world have gotten a bad lot. He goes, you know, after all, we all used to be black, and we all used to originated from Africa, after all. And then he explains to me, but then people from Africa migrated to Europe, and their skin became paler. After all, he says, you never seen a black polar bear, have you? And then he goes, and their brains became larger. And I'm going, uh-oh, we got something here. And then he's explaining to me in these strange pseudo-scientific ways that, you know, black people that reigned in Africa just had a much more simpler life, and they didn't need to develop it as much intellectually as white people in Europe. And, you know, and I'm like, okay. And then I said, okay. I'm thinking. And I said, well, let me ask you this. This woman who testified about the taillights, would it have affected your judgment on the matter if you had known that she is a police informant? And he says, absolutely not. He says, you see, it's like this. Black people don't scheme against other black people. They just scheme against white people. And I'm going, oh, man. But folks, they not only allowed him on the jury, they put his wife on the jury with him.
Regardless of race or religion or color, like personal beliefs, like, I didn't think that you could even do that by putting spouses together on a jury. That seems incredible.
I have never heard of that before. That's incredible. And it's not like it's a tiny little town with a tiny jury pool. This is a big metropolitan area. And somehow they ended up on the jury together.
Yeah.
And you stop and think about this. You know, the judge will always give the admonition to jurors. Don't discuss this case amongst yourselves until you're actually in deliberations. Okay. What are the odds that a husband and wife go home after sitting through 8 hours of testimony in this dramatic murder case? Can't talk about it with you, dear. Nope. Can't discuss it. I mean, it's just, but even beyond that, my wife, if my wife and I were on a jury together, she wouldn't be the least bit upset about upsetting me. I mean, that wouldn't bother at all. But a lot of spouses would be very reticent to cross their spouse on a case. You know, you'd be hard to press to, render a verdict based solely on the evidence and not on the feelings of the person you go to bed with every night. You know, I mean,
that feels so strange to me that during the interview process of you know, your jury interview process, when they ask you, is there any reason why, one of them didn't say, well, that's my husband or that's my wife over there. You know, like
they knew it was they were spouses when they picked them. I talked to the defense attorney. He said, I didn't want a husband and wife on the jury. I didn't want a white South African on the jury. But he said, Scott, the reason they were on the jury is because there were 10 Iowans on there that were possible jurors that were far worse. And I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, so they were just the least worse of the people.
They were the least worse.
That's good. I want to talk about the junk science that you talk about in the podcast, which was interesting. You talked a little bit about forensic evidence and the trash bag being some of the limited forensic evidence. And I don't know why it stood out to me, but there's a lot of talk about junk science and the CSI effect. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, you got to remember back in 1990 when I was a young police reporter, the whole idea of DNA testing was very, very novel. It occasionally would happen. Like, it only happened a few times before that. I mean, it was very unusual. So the expectations for forensic evidence at that time were not near the same as they are today. You know, jurors today have been watching forensic files. They've been, you know, watching CSI, they're much more adept at that, and they want science. Not a lot there as far as evidence that was presented in court that's scientific in nature. Really, it comes down to those garbage bags, what it really comes down to, because that's about all there is. But I think there's going to be, when this case goes back to trial, I was kind of skipping ahead of myself. His first conviction, he was convicted with the jury with the white South African after a very short deliberation. That conviction was thrown out because it came out in court that he had been involved in the drug trade. And the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, that's prejudicial. That biased the jurors against him, and they threw out the conviction. He went to trial a second time, this time in Dubuque, Iowa. They had a change of venue. And I don't know if you know much about Dubuque, but at that time, it's the most homogenous city and one of the most homogenous states in the Union. I mean, it was a very, very white town. I mean, in fact, when I was in college, people would joke about Dubuque being so homogenous and so white. And you know, it's bad when you're in Iowa and people were joking about that. I mean, but at the time, they were having cross burnings in front of the handful of African-American homes that were in this community of 70,000. I mean, these people were being terrorized. They were so concerned about the lack of diversity in the community at the time. The city council was actually talking about trying to create a diversity program where they would recruit minorities to come in and live in Dubuque, to give their children a little bit more of an idea of, you know, how to interact with people from different cultures and different races and everything. And that was what sparked the cross burnings. People were very upset about it. So given all of this, of all the 99 counties in Iowa that they could move this trial to, they picked Dubuque to move it to. I mean, it's just like, this is insane to me. But so they moved it there, and this conviction got thrown out 20 years later when it came out that, one, the woman who testified was an undercover police informant, and that never got disclosed, and two, more than 70 police reports were never turned over to the defense, and some argue that those reports have evidence pointing away from Stanley Liggins' guilt. But I let me say something about the other witness, that the cellmate that testified against Stanley. Since so much his weight was on his shoulders after it came out that the other star witness was a police informant, I decided to hunt him down. And I knew he'd just gotten released from prison in Nebraska, and I knew he had family somewhere in Sioux City, Iowa. So I just drove out there and started pounding on doors. And I got to this house, and somebody with the same last name, and I knocked on the door, and I asked, "Is Frank Rising here?" And they go, "Nope, we don't have anybody named Frank Rising." And I look in the door, and I see a guy sitting on the sofa, and I said, "Sorry, you know, I looked on Facebook for Frank Rising's picture, and you look just like him. You're his brother, aren't you?" "Yeah, yeah, I'm his brother. Come on in." So we come in, and I talk to him and explain what I'm working on and why I want to talk to him. And he calls up his brother on the phone, hands me the phone, and I'm talking to him. And Frank goes, "I don't want to talk to you." I said, "Well, you know, I've driven 9 hours out here. I mean, can I just give me 15 minutes of your day?" "Nope, don't want to talk to you." And we're going back and forth. And I finally said, "Okay, guy, I know you've been married. Let me tell you something. I've driven 9 hours out here. If I don't come back with an interview, my wife is just going to kill me. Can you just give me a break and give me 15 minutes, or I'll have to put up with that when I get home? And you know what that's like." Long pause. "Okay, fine. Come on down to the construction site where I'm working." So I drove down to middle of the night. It's like 9 o'clock at night, to this construction site where he's troweling concrete. When he gets done with concrete, we go out in the middle of this parking lot. It's dark and we're alone. And I interview him. And I said, "Well, why did you, what compelled you to testify?" And he goes, "I didn't want to." I go, "Well, why'd you do it?" And he goes, "The police had the cell bugged. And when they heard Stanley Liggins say something to me, they called me in to the interrogation. They said, if you don't testify against Stanley Liggins, we're going to charge you with accessory after the fact to murder, and you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison." He said, "I didn't want to go to prison for the rest of my life." And I go, "What exactly did Stanley say?" And he goes, "Well, we didn't like each other, so we weren't speaking. But we were watching TV, and his court case came up on the screen on the news. And I said, that's you." And he goes, "Yeah, but they'll never get me for it." And I said, "That's all he said?" And he goes, "Yeah." It's like, well, that could be interpreted a lot of different ways. It could be interpreted, I didn't do it, so they aren't going to get me for it. Or it could be interpreted as, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not like he's just saying, "I did it, by gosh." Mm-hmm. So that, and now we know that there's, he's saying that the police threatened him with sending him to prison for a very long period of time if he didn't help him. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court says in interrogations, it's okay for police to lie. That's permissible. So now I know the prosecutor in the case says he doesn't think that actually happened, but why on earth would Frank Rising have a 20 some years later say that's why he testified? I mean, he doesn't have any reason really to lie about it now.
They had his cell bugged. Was it Frank's cell that they had bugged or Stanley's cell that they had bugged? And is that even legal?
It was cellmates. They were cellmates.
Oh.
And according to Frank, there's like a little speaker in the ceiling where they could like do PA announcements in the jail, but they can also listen in
sure.
to the cell.
Okay. Yep.
Now, take it with a grain of salt, because this is coming from a career criminal who's spent 25 years in prison, but this is the story he tells. So they could listen in and hear what he's saying. And of course, there's the expectation of privacy in the jail is not there. So they could get away with that. So there's some things there that kind of raise some red flags, but here's the thing that really is distressing to me. The stepfather of Jennifer is a guy who just constantly been in trouble. He'd been in and out of jail. He'd done a lot of things. He was most recently in jail for selling lookalike drugs. Supposedly he was really into selling fake mescaline. I mean, it's like, okay. I go, well, how do you create fake mescaline? And I was talking to somebody who knew him at the time. He used cake decorating stuff. And I'm like, okay. I don't claim to be an expert on such things, but he
makes sense. Did.
Okay. Not part of my scene, so I don't claim to be an expert on it. But his stepdad had his share of trouble with the law. And in fact, his wife, Jennifer's mother, began selling cocaine to raise money to get him bailed out of jail. I mean, that's what she has said. So anyway, after Stanley's second conviction, he got into a heated argument with his neighbors. And according to the neighbors who testified in court to this in a post-conviction hearing, he said something to the effect of, you know, I killed my daughter. I'm not the least bit afraid to do the same thing to you. Now, other people I've talked to who were there, like his wife, said, no, he didn't say that. He said something like, you know, people think I did this or something. And it's like, I don't care. I mean, what kind of parent tries to use the death of their child to threaten the neighbors? I mean, it's just weird. I mean, so we have that as an all. He's kind of been presented in the past as an alternate suspect. It's kind of a interesting notion there. I mean, the whole situation is just very, very troubling. Yeah. I mean,
how many people actually heard him say that? Because when there's some interpretation on that, right? Whether he said, hey, you know, my daughter was murdered, I wouldn't think twice to do the same to somebody. You know, it's the whole eyewitness accounts are not reliable and et cetera, et cetera. I feel like it's so muddy right there. And you would expect when I first started listening to the podcast, when the second you hear something about that, you're like, well, it's somebody like the father or the stepfather, or, you know, just like in Maura's case, you go to like the boyfriend. You know, it's always the boyfriend or the father. You know, it's somebody that they know. And I feel like this one is, I feel like there's a lot of really like gray areas with legalities and eyewitness testimonies, and frustrating.
And one of the things I like about this telling this story as a reporter is it's very different than, say, Adnan Syed, where you have this really clean-cut high school student who is accused of doing something just horrible. This guy, Stanley Liggins, is a tough man. I mean, he did 7 years in Mississippi for armed robbery. He stabbed a man to death in prison. He got acquitted for a murder in prison. He moves to the Quad Cities. He allegedly was involved in the drug trade. He was doing a lot of bad things. He's not somebody who garners a lot of sympathy. But on the other hand, when you look at wrongful convictions in this country, it's usually people like Stanley Liggins. It's usually not somebody who they just pulled off a church pew. It's usually somebody who is a pretty rough character to begin with and hasn't done anything in their life to make people take their testimony very seriously. So it's an interesting case. I mean, it can go, you know, there's a lot of things about this that are interesting. So the case is going to be coming up for trial sometime in the next year. It was supposed to come up for trial in May, and Friday, Stanley Liggins fired his defense attorney, and who was a public defender, and the judge allowed it. So they're in the process of assigning a new attorney to him, and it's going to come up for trial. But I really encourage your listeners to tune in and subscribe to Suspect Convictions, because, first of all, it's a fascinating listen going through you know, the 15 or 16 episodes we're going to have this season. We're finishing up the season here in the next few weeks. But also, this is a case that we're going to know an answer on before the years within the next year.
Yeah.
He's going up for trial, and they're going to do more research, and they're going to do more investigating, and we're going to follow this case. And when it comes up for trial, we're going to be there, and we're going to cover this day, and we're going to produce podcast episodes every day of the trial.
So oh, wow.
Here, understand.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. How are you guys going to cover the trial? And the trial is still taking place in this May 2017?
No, it was scheduled for this May. They're going to reset the date. We don't know what the date's going to be yet, but I would be very surprised if it's not within, you know, it's going to happen within the next year. I mean, okay. I would be very surprised if it doesn't. And it could be 3 months from now. It could be 6 months from now, but we're going to have this trial coming up. But in the meantime, the twists and turns in this case, you know, evidence that perhaps the police, police misconduct in the case, evidence of lots of prior bad acts on the type of the part of the defendant, but at the same time, we're learning so much stuff that will never come before the jury. They'll never hear about the 9-year-old girl that he sexually abused a month before Jennifer was killed. I went and interviewed her last week, and that episode's going to come out this week, where we talked to her, and she's now a woman in her 30s, and she's talking about what an impact it had on her life. And we hunted down a person who specializes in treating sex offenders. And we got her to give the background on Stanley, and she gave us, you know, thoughts on whether he would fit the criteria or not of doing a crime like this. And what compels people to do this stuff? I don't quite get it. I mean, maybe it's because we're normal pathologies, but that doesn't make any sense, some of the things that have happened here. So it's a fascinating case. Again, the name of the podcast is Suspect Convictions. I think I loved listening to Missing Maura Murray, and I think your listeners would also enjoy listening to Suspect Convictions.
I want to back up to the very beginning because we didn't ask you about the crime scene, and so you were one of the first people on the crime at the scene, seeing
right.
this 9-year-old girl burning on the ground in front of you. Mm-hmm. What was that like? And were you afraid that the killer was, you know, watching you or was still around? Did you look around, like, for your own safety?
You know, that's a weird thing, and I don't mean this in a braggy way. Very, very rarely do I ever worry about my own safety. You know, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4". If people looked at me, they think I was a football linebacker. I mean, maybe I wasn't bright enough or naive enough at the time where I just didn't really worry much when I was going out and doing these type of stories at the time, but I never really worried too much about getting hurt. When I got there, I got there at the same time as a patrolman, you know, I was standing there next to an armed police officer. So, you know, I don't think the thought even crossed my mind that there might be an element of danger there. Plus, you know, we're in the middle of this empty, school playground. So at 9 o'clock at night, so, you know, if there was an immediate danger, I think we would have seen him there or seen a car there or something. So that wasn't so much what I remember about the scene, but I remember just the image of seeing this child. Her hand was one hand was up, and it was like it was badly burned hand, and it was like a claw stuck up from the skin contracting and the ligaments and the muscles contracting into kind of a claw with one arm stuck up. They call it a typical pugilistic posture, with what often happens with burn victims. As the arms and the ligaments and everything, tendons contract, it usually goes into like a boxer stance. And I remember looking down and I seen the melted plastic garbage bags. I could see some elements of a purple dress and white lace. She'd gotten up dressed really nice that day, even though she was from an extremely poor family. They dressed her up really nice that day because it was school picture day, and she was so excited about it, and she wanted to get her picture taken. I remember just standing there, and the medical examiner got there, and I kind of laugh at this now, but back in those days, when you're a young reporter, you're always trying to find good sources and everything. So one of the first things I did was, when I needed a physician for myself, I picked the coroner to be my physician so I could get in good with him. So when he sees me there, he calls me over and he's feeding me evidence he has from the scene. You know, this is a girl, Scott. I think she's about 12. He was 3 years off at the time. He's giving me this information and real quietly, and I'm writing this all down. And I turn around and there's like a TV reporter over my shoulder, with his microphone broadcasting live everything this guy's whispering to me. So, you know, there's things like that happen to the scene.
You mentioned staying with the scene of the crime. You mentioned that she had been doused in gasoline, and Tim and I actually were texting while we were listening to this. I don't know if we were actually listening to it at the same time, but was it the smell that made you realize it was gasoline? Because we both were like, how did he know that it was gasoline? Maybe it had like some sort of color coming off of it, or was it the smell?
It was a presumption. We knew you can't just throw a match on a body and get it to start on fire. We knew that an accelerant was used. That was very obvious. In fact, the story I radioed in from the scene, I said an accelerant, perhaps gasoline, was used at the scene. And I think that was a fairly reasonable, educated guess. I mean, I guess it could have been kerosene, or it could have been paint thinner or something else. But typically in these type of crime scenes, it's usually gasoline that's used. What I remember about the smell, though, wasn't gas fumes. I remember the smell of burning human flesh. I mean, it was just this overwhelming, pungent smell. And I remember, this is a very weird aside, but I'm a history buff, and it was like, I remember going through my mind, hey, this is what Auschwitz smelled like every day. I mean, this is the smell of the worst humanity does to one another. I mean, it was just really horrible. And you could, yeah, that, and the other thing was, because I got there before the detectives and everybody got there, the crime scene tape hadn't been put up, and I knew that as soon as if I walked away from the body at all, they were going to immediately never let me go back near it. And I know this sounds maybe selfish, but I knew that my editors, who I was on the radio with, this is the days before cell phones, were going to be really angry if I wasn't on the scene until the body was moved. So I literally planted myself like 2-3 feet away from the body and would not move. I mean, I just would radio in constantly from the scene as detectives came over and I talked to them, and as the coroner came over and I talked to him, and other reporters showed up and they saw me there and they planted themselves like just like I did right next to me. And one of the most worst acts of bad journalism I've ever seen is all three TV stations flicked on the Klieg lights, zoomed in on this burning child's corpse and broadcast live for the 10 o'clock news. I mean, I just think about that. This is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. And suddenly it was something brought into everybody's living room all across the this whole community. I mean, it was just really a horrific thing. So, yeah, but I was standing there over the body for probably 3 hours and smelled her. I remember the when the firefighters got there, it was almost like a religious ritual, the kind of reverence that was displayed there by the police officers and the reporters and everyone else. They went out with a extinguisher with water in it, and they sprayed down the body. It was almost like you were watching some kind of religious anointment or something. You watched them put out the flames, and you just stood there really solemnly, like, wow, this is just sinking in, what kind of thing we're seeing. It was a very, very strange thing. And, you know, I hunted down some of the reporters for the podcast who were there that night. One of them was a year younger than me. I mean, she's brand new, fresh out of college, and now she's a very celebrated and well-known reporter in the Phoenix area. And she said, you know, it's strange that you called me, Scott, because last week I was driving down the highway listening to the radio with my two teenage sons, and the disc jockey said, have you ever seen something so horrible that you could never get it out of your mind? And she said, my son looks over at me, and we're on the way to the high school to drop him off. And she said, well, Mom, have you ever seen something like that? And she said, yeah, once, when I was at this murder scene. And she told the story about the murder scene. And she said, and then, like, within a week, you called me up and want to interview me about it. It's the first time I've talked about it since. I mean, it was really a traumatic experience for everybody at that scene. The police lieutenant that was there, that was in charge of the crime scene investigation and was doing all the CSI work there, when he was called to testify in court, he said he had a flashback where he literally, during cross-examination, thought he was back standing over her body. And he said he's never had that happen before or since. He said, Scott, I always thought it was nonsense when these Vietnam veterans would talk about having flashbacks.
Yeah, there is something to it. There's some talk in some of my favorite parts of the podcast that you have are about post-event memory and how you even misremembered whether you were there before the fire department, or, you know, you and. But it's clearly because you have this other thing that's so that no pun intended, was burned into your memory, right? And that has totally taken over. And it's like that detail of, like, was I first or was I 20 seconds before somebody else? It's not uncommon at all. And it's not surprising.
No, it isn't. It's not like there's a videotape that runs in our brain that records this stuff. And I prefer to think I'm right and I was there first. The firefighter, he very well may be right and he got there first. But we know we were there about the same time. But the thing is, I don't find my memory any more trustworthy than his memory. I have no reason to believe that I would remember this better than he would. But everybody who was at the scene has a little bit different memories about what was there, what they saw, what they experienced. And sometimes those memories are contradictory. And I don't think anybody's lying. I just think people remember things differently. And that's, you know, and the other thing that happens that is memories change as you gather more information. I mean, as I would go and interview people, one of the things that one of the people, you know, the memory expert that I interviewed, she said, you realize that as you, in the days following the murder, would interview people, your mind is subconsciously filling in the blanks of what you saw that night. And I go, wow, you really think so? And she said, that's the way memory works. Memory is not just a static recording of what was seen. It changes over time. And that's why so many eyewitness testimonies are so bad and so wrong and result in wrongful convictions. That's another reason why I'm a little bit skeptical of this woman who said she, even beyond her whether she was a police informant or anything else, when she looked out her window and said she saw taillights near the fire and she came forward a week later, is that strong enough testimony to base a conviction on? I mean, it's a really tough thing.
I'm afraid for this upcoming trial, because it seems like Stanley's probably the guy. I'd like to ask your opinion. Yeah. I mean, I don't know for sure, obviously, but we as podcast listeners are going to hear more than the new jury is going to hear. So as a podcast listener, if I were, you know, a jury based on the podcast, I'd probably vote guilty. But knowing that they're not going to hear everything, I am very skeptical that there's going to be a guilty verdict.
I think that there's a very this could go very much either way. And that's not trying to be trite here. But I mean, I think it's going to be a very difficult case to get a conviction on. Not because I don't think that the prosecutors are doing a good job. I think they have a very able prosecution team going on this. But the evidence is very thin. I mean, even when it came up the first and second trials right after the murder, the prosecutor that worked that case, a very talented courtroom lawyer, said it was the toughest case he ever prosecuted. It was the most difficult because there wasn't a lot of evidence. It was entirely circumstantial. And so the other thing that's happened is 27 years have passed and many of the witnesses are dead. And so you're going to have basically lawyers reading transcripts from previous trials or depositions, and you lose all the drama of courtroom testimony. You can't cross-examine a transcript. Plus, you know, it's the job of the jurors to determine the veracity of witnesses. You know, do they look over at their lawyer and look for a tip? Do they look down at their feet when they speak? What's going on? What's their demeanor like? They can't get any of that. All they can get is the words that are said. And I think it's going to be a lot harder to bring the immediacy of the urgency of this trial to the jurors. And they're not going to hear about Stanley Liggins' bad acts, almost certainly. And you know, prior bad acts. This is going to be a really tough case to try all the way around. I mean, so you asked me what I think. What I think is that Stanley Liggins is a very bad man, but he's not on trial for being a bad man. He's on trial for the murder of Jennifer Lewis. He was a bad man that had proximity to her. He had a history of harming at least one child. But, you know, it's just, if I was sitting on that jury and I didn't know those things, it would be a really tough vote to go one way or the other. I just don't know. I mean, it's just a tough thing, you know. I tried to find the stepfather, by the way. Divorced Jennifer's mother, and last we knew, he was. Went to a private detective. I'd never done that before in my career, and hired him to see if he could find where this guy is located. And I got an address in New Orleans, and I drove down there. Knocked on the door of this big apartment building. Turns out it's a drug rehab center for homeless people in New Orleans. They wouldn't tell me if he was there or not. So I hired another private investigator to work and try to locate him. And he found a number of places where he had been in New Orleans and different homeless shelters and different places. And I went back down there with my nephew, who just graduated from Army MP training. And I was literally going underneath interstate underpasses in the middle of the night with a flashlight and a picture of him from his police mugshot and showing him to homeless guys and saying, hey, you seen this guy before? Yeah, I know him. That's Ace. He panhandles over here. Oh, I know him. We see him all the time over at this place. I probably interviewed over 100 people living on the streets down there. And Lots of folks knew him, but we never found him. So he's another missing part picture piece in this puzzle. Is he? Where is he? What's he doing? Will testimony that he provided earlier be allowed in if he's still alive? You know, but we don't know where he is. I mean, there's just a lot of things here that are big question marks. I mean, it's a tough cuff case. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to be sure and do with this, and one of my biggest beefs, I thought Serial did a wonderful job. I love the work they did with it. But one of the things I had a beef about is they didn't do much about who Hay was as a person. The victim was really kind of overlooked in the mix. It was very focused on the accused. And so I spent a whole episode just looking at Jennifer's life and hunting down people who knew her, teachers, social workers who had visited the family over the years, talked to her mother extensively, talked to other people, and kind of put together a picture of who she was and what her life was like. And I think one thing we can't lose sight of in this is we look at guilt or innocence for Stanley Liggins is the tragedy of who Jennifer was and what the life she lived. It was a tragedy, and the death that she experienced was obviously a tragedy as well. So I think that's really important.